720 WGN, the Sopranos theme. You remember the Sopranos? They were criminals. How are you, Mike?
John, I am just wonderful. And let me say this, Jeff and I are both thrilled, even though I'm here by myself, to have the opportunity to speak with you and your listeners.
Oh, let me make sure I got the correct last name. Mike Gentile, yes?
That's me, Mike Gentile. Actually, Mike Gentile Jr., I am.
Mike, you're Mike Gentile Jr. Okay.
I am.
And you and your brother wrote a book called Mob Adjacent, A Family Memoir, which pretty much blew my mind. Let's see, how am I going to set this up? First of all, what caused you to write the book?
Jeffrey has been writing books, John, for years and years and years. And on the back cover of one of his completed works, he used the term mob adjacent. Hmm. And I said to him that nothing describes our lives better in two words than that terminology. Because growing up, because of where Dad grew up and where he was born, our life, we did indeed live next to it. We were allowed to see things other people weren't allowed to see. We were allowed to hear conversations maybe we weren't supposed to hear. But being next to it allowed us a different lifestyle as children.
I'll say that is an understatement. So before we get into the actual recounting of events that really happened and the names of people who do and did exist, how in the world were you able to write what you have included in this book without fear of repercussion from the outfit?
Well, when this idea came to my mind, Jeff and I talked about it, and I decided that since I was the one who was put in the forefront and dabbled with that type of lifestyle as a youth and in my mid-20s and 30s, that I would go ask someone that I knew was still, let's call it, in the game.
All right.
And I explained to him what we had in mind, and he looked at me, John, and he said, Mike, you're not going to uncover any secrets, are you? And I said, well, buddy, I really don't know any secrets. And he said, well, tell the truth. Everybody you're talking about is dead, and have some fun with this.
So even generations that are still around wouldn't have trouble with some of this?
Every single thing that's in that book, I got a blessing for, Johnny.
Wow.
If you look at some of the stuff with the Cerrones, for instance, yes. I'll just throw a name out there. A lot of the pictures came from Skip's grandchildren. We were very close with that family up until my last honorary uncle, Tony, passed away. And I'm still friends with his children and his daughter, Rosa. My uncle Tony Cerrone's daughter, Rosa, gave us a lot of pictures and a lot of insights. And we compared a lot of stories, John, because we spent a lot of time together on barbecues and special events where families got together as just families. You know, it wasn't a mob get together per se. It just was a birthday party or a Sunday barbecue. And, you know, when you're a kid, what happens to you every day is pretty much you think it's normal.
Absolutely.
And so we thought everybody lived our life, John.
Yeah. Well, I think that's totally to be expected. When did you first realize that some of the stuff that these people who would come in and out of your home or whatever, when did you first realize that maybe something different was going on with them?
Well, you know, we had, if you take a look at the time frame, when my dad was in his heyday of being, we like to refer to him as the mob bartender, he ran a bunch of places for the Cerrone guys that were just regular taverns. He had a place on Clyburn Avenue when he came home from the Army, and then he graduated to a place right across the street from the traffic court called The Bridge on Clark Street.
Oh, I know The Bridge.
John, he operated that place until, well, probably 1964 with my uncle simultaneously. But when my dad got the opportunity to take and move to Mannheim Roads, a.k.a. Yeah. Glitter Gulch, he obviously jumped at the opportunity. So when he moved there, him and my uncle simultaneously ran Clark Street. And that was a place that was purchased by a wonderful young Greek family, and they owned it for 45 years, John. It was called the Aquarius Pub.
Wow. Well,
they bought it from my Uncle John, and they stayed there for 45 years. It was a very lucrative place. And when my dad had it, it was a meeting place for everybody who had to go to court. They would stop at the bridge, and they would meet their attorneys, and they would talk about what was going to go on across the street, and then they would go about their business. But there was a place, and keep in mind, I had to be 5 or 6 years old. I couldn't have even been in there more than once or twice. I don't have any real memories.
Right.
Just conversations about what went on in the place. You know, it was like a judge's chambers, if you will, because, you know, you could go in there any time, and a judge could be sitting next to an attorney who could be sitting next to a criminal having a sandwich and a drink.
welcome to Chicago.
Welcome to Chicago, is right. And, you know, all of our honorary uncles were just that. You know, because Dad worked all night, you know, he would come home at 3 or 4 in the morning, and, you know, we would be in school during the school year, and in the summertime, was, you guys got to be quiet, your father's sleeping. Well, by 10 o'clock, he was up, and the parade of honorary uncles would come to our home. We had a little brick bungalow in Bellwood. We lived in Bellwood from, I want to say, 61 until I was old enough to move out. And they would come in, and they would visit, and it was Uncle Tony and Uncle Skip, and it was Uncle Jimmy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when things came to light, I used to run out to get the Sunday newspaper. I was an avid Cubs fan from the time I was old enough to read. And by accident one day, John, I swear to you, I looked at the front page of the paper, and it said, suburban man indicted in multi-state gambling ring. I'm looking at the newspaper, and my goodness, if that's not my Uncle Jim, my eyes aren't working too good. So I run in with the newspaper and show my brother, and I say, Jeff, this looks like Uncle Jim to you. I'm not kidding you, John. From that moment on,
yeah,
I was enamored with that
lifestyle.
Okay?
Hold on.
And because I was so close to a clone of my father, he pushed me towards the light instead of telling me to close my eyes and put glasses on. He allowed me privileges and things that Jeff didn't necessarily get because my goal was to get out of high school and make my dad proud. My brother needed a master's degree to do that.
Gotcha.
You know, and we're two different people. The success of this book comes from me living the grittiness of some of it and Jeff's ability to turn what I say into what you read and love.
Right. And we're going to get it.
We couldn't do it without each other. And we became best friends, John. I mean, we're only 14 months to the day apart.
But we're going to get into
as polar opposite as you could imagine.
Mike, we're going to get into the grittiness of it in just a minute when we come back on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, it's 8:46. John Landecker in the midst of a conversation with Mike Gentile, who he and his brother wrote a book called Mob Adjacent, A Family Memoir. And it really is all of those things. Now, you were mentioning Jackie Cerrone, right?
Yeah, Jackie was a major player, but the major Cerrones in my dad's life were more Jimmy and Frank, a.k.a. Skip.
Well,
were brothers, Jimmy and Skip, and Jack was their first cousin.
Okay, I just want to read a section of I brought some sections of the book to read.
Well, right in.
to try to give a clue as to what stuff goes on in this book. It says, Jackie was a man of contradictions, a devoted family man who doted on his vivacious wife, Clara, and ruthless in business. He was a small, plump, bald man, about 5'6" and 200 pounds. Despite his lack of height, Jackie was a tough when he needed to be, and sometimes he needed to be. It said he was amongst the crew responsible for the gruesome 1961 torture and murder of outfit enforcer and juice collector William Action Jackson. After Jackson was wrongly suspected of being a rat, the three-day orgy of violence included baseball bats, guns, knives, cattle prods, ice picks, and a blowtorch. I mean, I read that and I go, what? That is...
I read that, and we actually, that's something that was written elsewhere. We certainly didn't hear any stories about that, John. But what I will tell you is, it's documented in other places, and to add to the authenticity and our ability to tell a story, some of that gruesomeness, if that's the proper word, needed to be included. Most of our encounters with Mr. Jack, we were young. We would see him at Orlando's Hideaway on a weekday when we were allowed to be the princes of the swimming pool. And we were all just, I mean, think about it now. I'm 65 years old now. In 1965, I was 9 or 10, depending on the month. So we were little kids. So growing up, that wasn't the level of mobster that I was dealing with.
Right.
That was obviously, he was a boss of bosses by the time I became a teenager. But he was one where if I would see him in Tom's Steakhouse, I would be amiss if I didn't walk up and nod my head and say hello, Mr. Cerrone.
Yeah.
And he would say, my name is Jack.
Gotcha. All right.
Now but I had little or no dealing with that in particular Cerrone.
Gotcha. Now let's try this paragraph. The Congress Street Expressway represented more than progress. It represented an orgy of graft for organized crime. Think about it. By 1949, the outfit had a vice grip on nearly all trade unions. That meant every construction worker, truck driver, equipment operator, every truckload of supplies from asphalt and concrete to rebar, and every piece of light, medium, and heavy equipment meant a payday for the Chicago outfit. Giddy mob-connected union officials and outfit bosses bragged about the magnitude of the kickbacks from their tables at the Bridge and Orlando's Hideaway. Dad maintained the philosophy of hear no evil, see no evil, keep your effing mouth shut. He knew that if the outfit didn't take a cut from the construction budget, someone else would. That's how things worked in Chicago. That's quite a statement. Don't you think?
If you think about it, John, I mean, we can only look at it as youths, and the hold that they had up until what, maybe even before the Family Secrets trial, was still pretty much in control of the unions in a different kind of way. But when there were big projects going on, you know, the picked construction companies got the jobs. The Brighton Krugs did the work on the highways back in those days. And then when they could no longer do them, they changed their name to K5, and they continued to do the jobs. I just think that's the nature of what happens is in major metropolitan, or at least what did happen. I'm not sure that the same thing exists today, John. The outfit, if you will, is a shadow of its former self. I think everyone would agree. But I also tell you that your question about, you know, did I worry about a repercussion? I thought about it, and when I was assured that I was okay with anything I wanted to do, I felt relatively safe.
Relatively safe. Yeah, relatively
safe. Well, I mean, you never know. There's
you never know. Let's try this one. Hollywood, post-prohibition, the outfit looked toward labor unions as the next golden goose. Hollywood labor unions presented a particularly rich prize. Not to dip too deeply into history, a former Chicago pimp and whore beater turned labor leader named Willie Beoff briefly ran a $2.5 million ex-dollar extortion operation against the Hollywood film studios on the outfit's behalf. Beoff threatened a strike and other acts of malice unless the studios paid. They paid. A grateful United States government placed Willie Beoff in a witness protection program after he squealed. On November 4th, 1955, Beoff got behind the wheel of his truck and pressed his foot on the starter. That's all it took to activate the dynamite charge. Parts of Willie and his truck scattered across the front yard of the Phoenix home where he'd lived under a false identity for nearly a decade.
Well, there was a couple of those instances where we know that that occurred. There was another guy that that happened to, too.
Yeah, well, you know, you go to the movies, right? I mean, you see movies like Goodfellas and The Godfather and all this kind of stuff, and you see TV shows, and stuff like that is, you know, you think, does that really happen? And that really happens, doesn't it? I mean, or did?
Well, I would say that it did, John. I would think that that type of behavior and that type of, it's not there anymore. You haven't seen a mob, and I'm throwing up air quotes, you haven't seen a mob hit in 25 years. It just doesn't happen anymore. There's nothing that anybody wants to kill themselves over anymore.
Well, that's what I was thinking when I'm reading the book. Why does everybody just want to kill each other? I don't understand
where that's at. I think greed, John. I would think that greed and ego, and I think greed and ego about covers it. You know, your pile is bigger than mine,
right?
But I'm smarter than you. It got to be, for us, a world that we lived in that we couldn't understand on some levels. Because keep in mind, John, we were kids.
Right.
And that was our take on this. You know, we joke about you were playing the Sopranos music when it opened up. And we always say that Mob Adjacent is the Sopranos meets the Wonder Years.
That should be
I'm
your
saying,
move.
John, here we are in the middle of our idyllic life, John. We're raised in a sunny suburb on a block full of children our age. We're going to private schools. We've got a stay-at-home mother. Our life is, we couldn't have had it any better as kids.
Right.
All the honorary uncles, when I found out who they were, you know, into my teens, they allowed me they made me feel bulletproof, mm-hmm. that I could do no wrong. That if I had a problem, I could go to one of my honorary uncles. And it wasn't until my 20s that I had to do some of that stuff and drag my dad back into that business.
So your dad knew these guys because he owned bars and restaurants that the outfit, quote unquote, would frequent. And they were in the neighborhood. Well, and you were all growing up together anyway. I mean...
Go ahead.
No, you didn't know the neighbor's uncle this, uncle that, but they met your dad through bars and restaurants, right?
No, actually, my dad grew up on Grand and Ogden, and his classmates, John, in his eighth grade, and he didn't graduate high school, from eighth grade to Wells High School, Joe Lombardo, who we all know who Joe was,
yep,
was one of my dad's classmates, John DeFranzo, who we also all know who he was, just recently passed away, were my dad's classmates. So when my dad grew up in the neighborhood, he grew up with a real good reputation because of something that my grandpa Mickey did in the 40s, John, and that's what cemented us as Mob Adjacent. We were looked upon as a family. We lived on, like, Grand... in Ogden on Aberdeen Street, couple houses off of Grand Avenue. And back in the, my dad was born the day the stock market crashed, John, October 29th, 1929. And there was no depression in the Gentile house because Grandpa was a street peddler. Mm-hmm. He sold produce on the street with his horse and wagon.
Right.
And business actually got better for Grandpa. Because people had to eat and they were looking for bargains, you know, to feed their family during this terrible time.
You betcha.
And Grandpa, there was You remember, John, in The Godfather, the character in The Godfather 2 with the white suit on? He was the black hand from Sicily.
Oh, sure.
The arm on all the Italian vendors.
Yeah.
Well, the guy on Grand Avenue lived directly across from my grandma and grandpa on Aberdeen Street. His name was Vincent Benevento, and he was called the Cheese King of Chicago.
The Cheese
but
King.
Not only that, he was the black hand from Sicily.
Whoa.
And he put the arm on everybody in the neighborhood, John. Everybody had to pay $2, $3, $5, $8. And just like everybody else, Grandpa paid. But one day he was on his way to go pick up his horse and wagon, and Mr. Benevento was catching a licking in the alley. Grandpa stepped in and helped him so he didn't get hurt. They tipped their head and went each other's way. And from that time on, Mr. Benevento, out of respect for what my grandpa did to help him, didn't take any money out of my grandpa's route anymore.
Gotcha.
We stood like, you know, at least heads above the rest of the neighborhood for something that my grandpa did that you or I would have done too for a neighbor. Just happened to walk by and you see a guy across the street lives from you is getting beat up. You're going to help him. And that's what happened. And combining all of that, he got the respect in the neighborhood from my grandpa. My dad did, because Mickey Gentile was a stand-up guy, and his son Mike was the same way. And Skip Cerrone took my dad underneath his wing in probably, I want to say 46 or 47, John, when my dad had quit high school and bought his own truck and got a route up on the north side, and he was bringing some envelopes on a daily basis from the office on the west side to somewhere on the north side, just dropping off an envelope every day.
Just an
envelope.
He never
took any money.
Right.
He was just doing a friend a favor. And you know, when you do a friend a favor, you get a favor in return.
Sure.
And he wasn't working for them. And my dad was never arrested in his whole life. He was never named on one of those charts as an associate or an affiliate. But because of his reputation in the family growing up on Grand Avenue, he was one of those neighborhood kids who could be trusted.
Gotcha. Hold on a second there, Mike. We got to take a break. It's 9 o'clock. Time to get into the newsroom at 720 WGN. 720 WGN. I'm going to do an interview he can't refuse.
Oh, goodness.
Mike Gentile's on the phone. I got to tell you about this right now in case you're just joining us. Mob Adjacent, a family memoir. Michael and his brother Jeffrey wrote this book. In our world, the guy who baked the bread was as respected as the guy who stole the bread. And I think that statement right there is pretty much how things were looked upon. Would you say? I mean, it's a couple of sentences, but in there is a lot of meaning, so to speak.
It's more of not so much a lifestyle as a sign of the times back then, John.
Yeah. A couple of things. Explain Coffee And.
Coffee And is, the and could be anything from a dish of homemade cookies to a tray of cannolis to a cake. It's not necessarily what the end is. It's something sweet to go alongside your coffee. It's an Italian thing. My aunts made it famous because they were great bakers.
Gotcha.
There was always, the and was always there before the coffee with my aunts.
And if somebody was in college...
Well, back when we learned about college, it wasn't necessarily the university, but it was a school where you learned better behavior.
Prison. It was prison, right? Or jail.
Prison, yes. Yeah.
So, but literally, they would tell you kids that's, hey, what happened to Uncle So-and-so? I haven't seen him in a while. And they'd go, well, you know, he went to college.
Well, that's like saying they took your dog to the farm, John. Same nonsense. You're a child, you believe anything.
That's right. Well, of course you would.
They went as far as one of my honorary uncles came home, and they used the word graduate. Uncle Tony told me graduated from school. Yeah, three years at Terre Haute was school.
Bob and Jason, I got to make sure we get all the plugs in, because Bob and Jason, a family memoir, Jeffrey and Michael Gentile, is available from Eckhart's Press, and you can go to their website and check it out, and I can't recommend it more if you're interested in the history of the Chicago outfit in Chicago. I mean, this isn't about a national mob organization. This is about the guys that were like in Melrose Park who went to Slicker Sam's. You know how many times I went to Slicker Sam's in the early 70s? I can't tell you.
Did you remember, John, you remember the singing waitress?
I was going to mention that. Absolutely.
Oh, my God. My wife, she still sings Big Mary Carey, Proud Mary.
Proud Mary, keep on burning. Hold on. Of course I remember. Who was that?
Or she worked hard for her money.
Well, you know, we'd be out. You'd go out to Slicker Sam's. Place would be packed. Food was awesome. All of a sudden, somebody drops some money into the jukebox, and Proud Mary would come on, and this waitress would like go crazy. I mean, she'd be dancing up and down the aisles.
Oh my God!
It was awesome. Oh man, I saw that numerous times, but I didn't realize how close I was to. Well, I mean, there could have been outfit guys at the next table. I never would have known.
Oh, John, and I would be willing to bet you that every time you ever went in there was a half a dozen outfit guys in there.
Good God.
That was the place to be. I mean, when I first started dating my wife, my second wife in 1982, jeez, those restaurants in Melrose Park were our Leone's. Did you ever go to Leone's back in the day?
Absolutely.
George Leone used to let us park our car on the sidewalk, John.
Oh,
there was
God.
No parking space. Listen, Mike, put it on the sidewalk. If we need the space, the guy will move it for you.
Mike, I got to tell you, between 1973 and 1979, I'm just making up those years, Slicker Sam's in Melrose Park was the go-to place for most of the WLS air staff. Bob Surratt, myself, news people, also reporters from Channel 5 who were friends of ours. We'd go out there. I took my mom out there. We had a beer bill. We had a beer. We were buying Heineken's on tap by the pitcher, and the tab for the beer was $400. But there were, you know, there were quite a few of us there, if you know what I'm saying.
And then if you wanted to go throw the peanuts on the floor, you could go right across the street over by the Comeback Inn.
With the bear.
Yeah, with the bear, with the Kodiak bear. The guy that owned that place actually got that bear. Jimmy Cortino.
Oh, it's fantastic, man. I mean, the thing is about it, Mike, is, you know, it's criminal activity. I mean, I hate to, like, bring this back to reality, but, you know, these guys were not, their business was not, it was criminal. You know what I mean?
Let me tell you a statement that is as shocking as it is true.
Okay.
Talking to a person that I read that maybe he had killed people for that business. And he looked me right in the eye, John, and said, "We never killed anybody, didn't need killing."
Oh, I've heard that a million times.
And,
right,
John, there's, although no human being has the right to be judge, jury, and executioner.
Right.
But if that's the game you choose to play, which is an illicit and dirty game.
Yeah, that's the rules.
You violate the rules.
Yeah.
You know what the rules are going in.
Yeah, but even
I can't say anything about it.
Well, I'm not talking about murder per se. I'm talking about the business that the quote unquote businesses that they ran to get the money. I mean, that they weren't legitimate. They weren't legitimate.
In a lot of cases, you're right, but you got to remember it was a different era, John. I mean, you know, the kind of stuff that occurred in the '60s could not occur today. It's just not
so.
The same world that we live
so?
In.
You don't,
I don't
think so?
Why doesn't it? Would be my question. If someone had an argument for it, why has the strength and overall wherewithal of that business gone to? Why is it so, you know, not run down, but, you know, it's like my brother said, well, if you want a hooker, you don't need to go to an outfit place. You can call online and they send it to you, right?
So true.
If you want to gamble, you don't need to go to a book joint. All you got to do is go on your computer.
Exactly.
With a Caribbean thing, or you can go to a casino.
Right. Mike, stay on the line. We got to take a break. We're going to do it some more. Right after we come back, the book is called, man, it's unbelievable, Mob Adjacent, a Family Memoir. And we'll have more when we come back on 720 WGN. It was a Monday. It was a Monday night in Chicago. My name is Led Decker. I'm working the 7 to 10 shift on 720 WGN. I was talking to Mike Gentile. He and his brother had wrote a book called Mob Adjacent, the Family Memoir. It's got unbelievable stories, of which we are now going to have more.
Just the facts, man.
Just the facts. Oh, man. First, there's so many things running through my head all at once. Now, I'm going to take a big pivot here. Okay?
Pivot away, Johnny boy.
I'm going to pivot to something that's in the book. I'm not making it up. But, and it's the criticism of the Kennedy family.
Oof.
Which blew, I've never seen in print anyone say what is said in this book about the Kennedys, including Joe, President, Bobby. I mean, there is a vicious tone, to say the least, about the outfit's opinion of the Kennedys. Can you elaborate on that at all?
Okay. I'm going to take a breath, and I want to make sure I do this right.
Right.
The things that we reported that the Kennedys did, they did. We just reported them. Nothing that we wrote about any of the Kennedys, right from Papa Joe making his fortune cheating the Purple Gang on loads of sugar and bootlegging Cutty Sark scotch, is anything other than public record. So the squeaky clean image of the Kennedys in the Hyannisport volleyball games on the lawn come from the same dirty stuff that Bobby Kennedy, after Papa Joe, it's pretty much known that the Chicago outfit got JFK elected. They swung Illinois for JFK with the, we like to make jokes, and you can't see, but I'm throwing up the air quotes again.
Right.
Vote early and vote often.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The Mayor Daley machine, and they took and won the state of Illinois in our Electoral College votes, and those in particular votes put JFK in the White House. We didn't make that up. That's true.
Oh, no. I understand that. But the impression
now,
that... Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, because I want to make sure I answer this correctly.
Well, no, you are. Let's see, how do I put this? The impression that I got was, okay, hold on a second. We have, Papa Joe, JFK, Bobby, who becomes Attorney General and goes after all mobs, outfits. He's got a vendetta. He's going to clean up, quote unquote. He's going to put people behind bars. And the gist that I get from the book is that the outfit felt that the Kennedys were doing pretty much the same thing that the outfit was doing, only they were in office. Is that even close?
I think that the overall view was the Kennedys came upon their resources the same exact way the people that Bobby Kennedy was immersed in doing something to Sam Giancana.
Oh, you know,
and if we look at the way the whole thing went, and we actually, John, got to personally see Sam Giancana rip up Frank Sinatra about dealings with the Kennedys at my father's nightclub.
No kidding.
Actually, seen Frank Sinatra come down the steps, yep, and my father chase us out and begin to have a horrible, horrible screaming at. He wasn't screaming back. He was being screamed at.
Right.
For something Joe Kennedy had done with the Calneva Lodge.
Jeez.
Okay, that was all there. And that was all, right, again, stuff that Jeffrey wrote that he found other places and just reported on it.
Okay.
When everybody was so sad that the Kennedys were being victimized by organized crime, when it came up that maybe, you know, the assassination wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald. Really?
Wait a minute.
The way they about their power, I keep going back to the way they came about their power.
Yeah.
Joe Kennedy meets with Sam Giancana on a Tuesday night and tells him that Jack is going to lay off of them as a reward for them getting him elected. And the next day, Bobby Kennedy is ripping Sam Giancana to pieces. Well, he's laughing at him. And in the tape, if you look at the tape, Bobby Kennedy says to Sam Giancana, "Only girls giggle, Mr. Giancana." And he continued to laugh because in their mind, what the Kennedys perpetrating was a joke. They weren't this bulletproof, squeaky clean image of America, Camelot, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little more different than that. I mean, go back to Sam Giancana and the president shared a mistress.
Yes, right.
I mean, we know that. You know that. It's not nothing that I'm. It's one of those secrets that I'm not uncovering.
Right.
And our family's view and all of my honorary uncles, and again, not for me as a father and grandfather to condone what happened to those men. I don't. But when you make promises at the magnitude of the promises they made and then go directly against them, my goodness, what do you expect to happen? I mean, I'm just saying, you answer that question for me.
Well, as I was reading the book, now I hope I'm not going too far, it is implied, as far as I could tell, from what I was reading, the book implies that both of those assassinations, the JFK and the Bobby, were outfit organization hits.
Well, that would be the implication that we get to, and we certainly have no knowledge other than what we've read,
right,
and what we've put down in copy. But the conversation and some of the stuff that reigns true, you know, J. Edgar Hoover in that point in time, you know, he was doing funny stuff. And the single gunman theory,
yeah,
well, you know what I mean. The single gunman theory worked. If there's no conspiracy, you put it to bed and poor President Kennedy got assassinated by, and I mean, they were both on the payroll of the CIA at the same time, Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby. I mean, this is all stuff that we just read on and reported on, John. But what we could tell you was that there was a severe dislike amongst Italian Americans that had any idea of what kind of behavior the Kennedys did, what they actually did. And again, whether or not what happened to them was something that someone perpetrated or it was, I mean, I don't know where the Sirhan thing is an outfit hit. I don't know that. You know, there's a lot of different theories about killing the president. But again, I don't know, John. It's a question that probably will never be answered.
I just wanted to touch on it because it is in the book. Now, let me pivot completely away from that and go to the revelation that your brother was gay. Talk about that.
We, growing up, Jeff was just different. You know, he was more into to watching TV and watching books as opposed to us kids going out and finding a sixth guy to play football.
Yeah.
It was different. He was smarter. He could write and draw from the get-go. When he went away to college, his knowledge of this life that he now has a front row seat to, he didn't have a lot of knowledge of it. And for my father, I think it was really hard, John, to think that, because they didn't understand it. And I don't think they ever wavered in their love. I think maybe my father might have been a mite disappointed, but they always stood behind Jeff 100%.
As Jeffrey writes in the book, the first thing Dad said was he loved me, quote, no matter what. He told me to remember that. Mom echoed his sentiments, no matter what. She said she'd had suspicions, but there had always been a comfortable distance between suspicion and confirmation. Then Mom delivered the stipulation that went along with their unconditional love. I could continue to attend family events and celebrations, but a male partner would not be welcome, not ever. So I see how that works. No. What we're talking decades ago. I mean, I can see how that works. And that's all I can say about it, really. I mean,
here's what I'll tell you, John. It would be different if I had a gay son than if my father had a gay son.
Right. Absolutely.
He didn't understand it. My mother thought it was a virus. She asked him till he died when he was going to get married and bring her grandkids. She thought it was if you took an aspirin, you'd be over it.
Wow.
Jeff and I grew close, closer than ever during the construction and the putting together of this book. You know, he liked to tell Larry Potash from Channel 9 News that I was the crate that he came in. You know, I'm the rough one. I'm the one who was subject to all of the, actually all of the benefits of that life. You know, Jeff didn't know from Skip so much, and I mean he knew Jimmy, but he didn't know who they were. Do you remember back when you were first doing, you were John Records, and the two guys for the Sun Times, they were outfit followers. They were Art Patak.
Yes.
Yeah, and the other guy's name was...
I forget.
Hugh Huff. And my friends used to call me Patak, because anytime anyone wanted to know anything about the outfit, I seemed to be able to know.
Mike...
Because I listened, Johnny, I listened. I would listen. My father would talk, and I would listen, even when stuff I wasn't supposed to be hearing.
I got you, Mike. Listen, we have to wrap it up. I want to thank you for being with us. What an awesome story you tell. Jeffrey and Michael Gentile Jr., the book is called The Mob Adjacent, a family memoir. It's available from Eckhart's Press. That's Eckhartz. And we didn't even scratch the surface on some of the amazing revelations and stories that are in here. Thanks, Mike. I really appreciate you being on tonight. Be safe.
Johnny, thank you for everything.
You
God bless you, buddy.
You too. 9:30, time to go to the WGN Newsroom.